Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and I'm joined today in a conversation with David Nahai. He's an environmental attorney, a political activist. He was the former general manager of Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. He's been part of the Clinton Climate Initiative. He's the head of David Nahai Associates, and he's a member of the Regional Water Quality Control Board. He's a friend. Delighted to have him on the show today. David, welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. It's great to see you today. How are you?
Thank you, Ted, and it's great to see you as well. And it's a pleasure to be with you.
Good. And as I said, we're going to do a short interview, and we've got a lot of ground to cover. So we'll just dive right in. I really want to talk with you about water. Obviously, your role in the Water Control Board, the Regional Water Control Board. But it seems like your interest in water goes way back in your life to your youth in Iran. And I read in an article that you were discussing this whole notion of Salak, or this common skin disease. And that was an early trigger in your life to get you on this path that you've been pursuing. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. I was asked, so what was it initially that piqued your interest in the environment and led you to become active in the environmental arena? And in thinking about it, I think it was that. My father was a sufferer of this skin disease called Salak, and it's a disease which it scars the face. My father was a very resilient, very successful, very handsome man, but nevertheless, he carried this throughout his life, and it struck me at a very young age that this was an example of a government's betrayal. That if there was a central basic responsibility that a government has towards its people, is to provide a clean environment, clean air, clean water. And for me, everything starts from there. And so I think at a very young age, it struck me. And I think as looking back on it, I think it's informed a lot of what I've done in the environmental arena.
And now we're going to fast forward to the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And you have been on the board, chairman most of the time, it seems, for four different terms, or is it four different gubernatorial appointments? Or you've been, talk about how long you've been there right off the bat and what it is.
It's correct. I've been appointed by four different California governors to the Water Board. And so I served three terms under three governors consecutively, and then I had a break from it where I went to lead the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power as its general manager. And then I came back mostly to the private sector, but then last year, Governor Newsom reappointed me to the Water Board, and I was confirmed by the state Senate for the fourth time as a Water Board member.
Talk about the Water Board, because there's the state Water Control Board, right? And then there's nine regional water, then gets into Water Quality Control Boards. Is that right?
Right. Yes. There's the State Water Resources Control Board.
There we go.
And there are nine regional water quality control boards. I mean, that is the name, but I think as for our region, it goes beyond just taking care of water quality. More and more, the Water Board is becoming part of the water supply, water quantity kind of apparatus of the region. Our region, Region 4, is Los Angeles County, Ventura County, parts of Kern and Santa Barbara counties, home to something like 10 million people, with 99 cities. It's a very complicated kind of area to have jurisdiction over, but it's the regional board's responsibility to protect water quality throughout the region. That's coastal waters, surface waters, rivers, and groundwater as well. So it's something like 4,000 square miles and 120 miles of coastline. It's a vast area.
So interesting. And then now the State Water Resources Control Board, that's part of the California EPA, is that right?
Yes, and so are the regional boards. They're all part of the Cal EPA.
And so you have an authority, obviously. You can set policy, is that right?
Yes, for our region, we have the following kind of areas of responsibility. It's planning and assessment. That's like setting what are called total maximum daily loads or TMDLs. It's doing the basin plan in order to arrive at what level we call clean in terms of water quality. We have a permitting function to basically regulate the pollutants that get discharged into our rivers. We regulate sewage treatment plants. We regulate the 99 cities within our jurisdiction in terms of controlling urban runoff pollution, everything that gets left on the streets that washes out to the ocean. We have an enforcement function to enforce against people who don't who don't observe the law and cause pollution. We have to regulate contaminated sites to try to bring them back into productive use. So it's a very broad portfolio, both of responsibilities and powers.
Yes, I must say, and I don't think that the average person knows that. I certainly didn't understand even it. I had no idea the breadth of your responsibility and your powers as you've described it. Can you give an example where the board had to sort of lay down the law the rubber hits the road here? Where maybe somebody was polluting and you had to come in, swoop in, and how you handled it?
Yeah, well, I don't think I should discuss specific cases, but we do have a case that's coming up right now where a very substantial fine is being imposed against a polluter or somebody who's alleged to be a polluter, and we will have to go through the process. So there is that enforcement that happens. But I think one of the most significant things that we've done recently is the issuance of a permit called the MS4 permit. And what the MS4 permit does, and this is the permit that's issued to the 99 cities that are within the regional board's jurisdiction. And basically, the permit recognizes that the largest threat to our coastal waters right now comes from urban runoff pollution. It comes from all of the detritus of society that gets left on the streets and whenever there's any kind of rain or gets washed out to the ocean, untreated, pollutes the beaches, adversely affects our coastal economy, makes people sick who swim and recreate, our kids who recreate at our beaches. So the idea here is to require each city to take care of what gets left on their streets so as to reduce the threat to the ocean. It's a very complicated process to go through, to try to ask cities who are far away from the ocean, but nevertheless are connected to the ocean through our vast storm drain system, to spend the money, the time, the resources to ensure that that whatever is left on their streets from pesticides and bacteria and trash and oil and cigarettes and so on, that they prevent that from polluting the coast.
Yeah. Let's talk about the drought, the current drought. And we've had another record-breaking drought. Is this the new normal? And you talked about how you have gotten now involved through the board. You've been involved at also the supply side of the equation.
Yes. I mean, you know, I've dealt very much with the supply side when I was the general manager at LADWP. And I think really supply and quality of water are indistinguishable. They're two sides of the same coin, really. I don't know how you feel, Ted, but I don't want to call it the new normal because we shouldn't accept that this is normal. It's not. It's anthropogenic climate change. It's what we have done to our own planet, and it's deplorable, actually. But we're feeling the effects of climate change, and as a result, I believe we have to expect that we're going to have these long years of severe drought, with all of the really horrific impacts that come with it, from wildfires to farmers having to fallow their land, to people's health getting endangered because of extreme heat events, and so on. So we have to mobilize in order to deal with those impacts, what we call adaptation or resilience. But I do believe that these periods of extreme dryness will be followed with periods of extreme precipitation, more rain that we will want. I think those are the predictions for the patterns of climate change. And I think that that is what we can expect to happen. What we have to try to do is to make sure that when that rain falls, that we're able to capture it and not let it hit all of our impervious surfaces, our streets, our roofs, our freeways, and wash out to the ocean to be wasted. So I think we have to just flip our water paradigm, our water supply paradigm, on its head and think about it completely differently. The days of being able to import cheap, plentiful water, which is what our model has been here in Southern California, I think those days are numbered. And I think we've long recognized that. We have to do things differently.
Yeah, agreed. And what kinds of things did you do when you were at DWP to reduce water?
Well, I'm very proud of the success that we had in reducing water consumption because it was not something that people were terribly used to. But we did it using a number of different tools. I think primarily a public education, outreach to remind people that we're all in the same water boat. And that conservation is something that helps all of us. We deployed, qualified people to go out into neighborhoods and talk to people who looked like they were wasting water, and remind them of their responsibilities. And we gave these people the ability to actually issue tickets for wasting water. We introduced a whole number of incentives, such as cash back for people who would, get rid of their lawns and replace it with artificial turf, or rebates on water saving, equipment and gadgets and so on. But also, I have to say, we also deployed shortage year rates, which basically meant that the more water you use, the more you're going to pay for it. So we appealed to the better nature of people. We provided incentives through through, you know, rebates and so on. But we also had to bring in sticks in terms of tickets and higher water rates. And, you know, I like to think, Ted, that what was most successful was the public outreach campaign. But I can't be sure. All I know is that the combination of these things worked.
Yes, I can well imagine that there are some that would only respond once their pocket is burning, once the bill is burning a hole in their pocketbook.
And I have to say, there are some who won't respond even then.
Even then, of course not. They need their lawns, of course. And then I think I read in one of the articles as I was preparing for this discussion about you talking a little bit about Israel's success with really reusing all water or almost all of it instead of letting it go out to the ocean. Is that a fair statement that they are quite ahead of us in terms of water efficiency in that regard?
Yes, in terms of wastewater recycling, they certainly are. They recycle 80 to 90% of their wastewater. Now, they recycle most of it for agricultural use, and doing that, they've been able to make the Negev bloom. But, you know, I don't think we need to go as far as Israel or Singapore to see models of successful wastewater reuse. We can just go down the 405 freeway to Orange County. Mm-hmm. The Orange County Water District basically subsists on treated wastewater, and so there we are, in a very conservative community, and yet a lot of their water, and the majority of it, is treated wastewater. And they all look perfectly healthy to me. So we need to do a lot more here in Los Angeles and throughout California.
As I understand that system, the water does go through the filtering of the natural soil, right? Getting down into the aquifer, and it recharges the aquifer. So it's really using a biological system to filter, right?
Oh, yeah, correct. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that system is called indirect potable reuse. So the wastewater is treated to a very high degree with reverse osmosis and ultraviolet treatment and so on. I mean, it really is treated to the umpteenth degree. And then it's transported to spreading grounds and allowed to filter through the soil for additional cleaning to replenish groundwater, and then it's extracted and treated again before being served to the public. Now, that's indirect potable reuse. We have the technology today for direct potable reuse. And I know that there are regulations being developed at the State Water Board to ensure that the direct potable reuse will be safe, as safe as indirect potable reuse is.
Why don't we do more of that? What's the barrier? Start with the indirect or the direct. Either one. Is it a cost? It sounds like it's not a technological barrier. Is it a cost barrier, or is it really a human reluctance to adopt water systems like that?
I think, you know, as with most things in life, it's a number of things. I think previously there was some kind of, in my view, unjustified psychological resistance to the idea, but it was unwarranted. And I'm absolutely certain that today we're over that. I don't, in all of what I do and all of the people that I speak to, I don't see that as being any kind of an issue. Now, with everything water, one has to think about cost and investment. So while we were in this while we've been in a situation that we can get water here in Los Angeles from the Sacramento Delta, from the Colorado River, from the Owens Valley, and have that water come to LA from hundreds of miles away, cheap and abundant, it doesn't provide any kind of incentive to invest in other things, stormwater capture, wastewater recycling, and so on. But as that water becomes scarcer and more expensive, it now compels us to produce our own water from different sources. And now within the hierarchy of the kinds of things that we can do, there are cost and investment considerations all along. So for instance, the cheapest water is water that is conserved, right? Water that's just not used. Wastewater recycling has a cost. Stormwater capture has a cost. Aquifer, cleaning of our aquifers has a cost. But more and more, these costs are becoming comparable, if not cheaper, than imported water. I think the most expensive of the kind of water fixes is ocean desalination, which is by far the most expensive way to go, and therefore probably the lowest on the priority ladder of what one should do.
Interesting. I'm glad you touched on that. I had written down desalinization as you were talking there. Let's talk about the tension between agriculture and people, I guess, in urban populations in California. I mean, it's some extraordinary the amounts of water that go into growing things that we export. I mean, I think almonds, isn't it true that the almond crop requires as much water as San Francisco and Los Angeles combined, or massive amounts of water going to agriculture? And how do you feel about that? And where's the balance? And does your board get involved with that? Or does that happen at the state level? Or?
Well, our board does get involved with it. And it is coming up in terms of mostly in Ventura County, which has a lot of agriculture, not in LA County, which has hardly any at all. And so I won't comment on it at length, because we're going to be considering the ag permit that's going to be coming up, and I don't want to leave the impression that I've prejudged anything, because I haven't. I have to sit there and listen to the evidence that is presented and come to a decision as to the regulations that are going to be issued. I will say this, the ag community will dispute very vigorously the idea that they're water wasters or that they use untold amounts of water, that they're profligate in the way that they use water. That being said, it's clear, I think everybody knows, that there are certain crops that are thirstier than others. You've mentioned almonds, cannabis, a very thirsty crop, and there are many illegal cannabis production sites that take water that they shouldn't be taking. So I think as we go forward, the issue of the kind of crop that's being grown will become an important one. I don't see ag and municipal as different. I see us all being Californians and all being having to collaborate. So for instance, if we take the city of Los Angeles, Ted, if we conserve more, if we capture our rainfall, if we recycle our wastewater, if we clean up our groundwater basins, and therefore reduce our dependence on imported water from Northern California and from the Colorado River, well, necessarily that will leave some water for others, right? So in doing that kind of thing, we've not only helped ourselves gain a measure of independence, but we've also relieved the burden on others. And I think it also kind of will provide us with the moral high ground to then be able to say to others, look at the investment that the people of Los Angeles have made. You know, rates have risen. There have been financial sacrifices. There have been, innovation that's been done here. What will you do to do your, fair share of ensuring that California as a whole can thrive and get over the water crisis, which I think is going to become water crises over many years.
So we're seeing, you're suggesting a movement towards net zero water, just as we have a sort of a net zero energy movement.
Yes, I don't know that we get there with water. It's a different, water is just different. You know, people view water as sacred. We can't live without it.
Yeah.
And there is a sacredness to water, which yes, people get anxious when the power goes out, but they don't fear death. At least not for the most part. Here in Los Angeles, we cannot imagine a situation in which we turn the tap and nothing comes out. We can't conceive of it. Yeah. And I think we have a responsibility to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Right. But maybe we're moving towards water self-sufficiency, I guess a better way of putting it. Through very efficient use, stormwater capture, rainwater capture, reclamation practices, the whole bit. It's a fantastic pursuit. I'm so glad that you're at the water board and putting all of your professional energy into it. What would you say you're most passionate about? I mean, I know you wrote a book on commercial real estate. You work in energy. You represent companies that are overseas and them doing business here and vice versa. Well, where do you get your most enjoyment? What are you passionate about at work?
People distinguish between work and not work. I don't. I think I'm kind of like you when it comes to that. My work, whether it's my consulting work, my legal work, my investment work, the time that I spent writing, two books on commercial real estate transactions, it's not work. It's how I live my life. But I think if you say, what is it that you find rewarding? Well, yes, I find my private sector work, my law firm, my consulting company, our investment company, I find all of that rewarding. But it doesn't begin to compare with the satisfaction one gets from public service. So the Regional Water Board, I'm chairman of the Los Angeles Business Council, a progressive business organization that truly understands that business can play an enormous role in fighting the climate crisis. Recently, Ted, I became chair of the Business Advisory Council to the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District, Superintendent Carvalho. And that's a role in which one looks at schools and sustainability and how to green campuses and so on. And I I just feel so, I feel privileged to be a part of these things. And these things fuel my passion.
That's great. Really well put. How exciting. How exciting. And there must be times when you just want to unplug from it all. And how do you do that? How do you maintain a balance? You when you got on the call, you obviously had a busy day, I could tell.
I do reserve some time to myself. You know, I go to the gym, I work out, I try to take care of my health. In the evenings I spend time with my wife. We've been enormously fortunate, Ted, to now have a granddaughter. She'll be turning 3 soon, and she's just I don't know, FaceTiming with her and spending time with her is a delight. But in terms of balance between work and other pursuits, I don't have a good balance. I like to say, you know, 50% of my time goes on my law firm, 50% on my consulting company, 50% on other business matters, 50% on the regional board. So I've never been good at striking that balance. I'm sorry to say.
Well, you love what you do, and you're making a big difference. So keep going to the gym and taking your vitamins, David. But thank you so much for this discussion today. It's been great to spend a few minutes with you and to learn from you about the water board. It's fascinating. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you so much, Ted. And I always learn from you too. And it's just such a pleasure to see you and spend some time speaking with you. Thank you.
Great. Take care, David. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.